everyone. Welcome to the Charge Podcast. Today, I am with my friend Anna Goldman again for part two in a series of two episodes on women's health. Anna is a holistic women's health nurse practitioner. She is amazing and has so much knowledge to share with us. So if you haven't listened to the first episode yet, make sure you do so. We will definitely link it up in the show notes. For people who haven't listened to part one of this series yet, can you share a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I am a women's health nurse practitioner, and right now I work in a couple of different jobs. I'm a clinical instructor at a nursing school teaching their OB department. And then I'm also working at a holistic clinic here in Denver, providing clinic services to women.
Let's do a little recap of what we talked about in the last episode. So we talked all about hormone health and went in depth on birth control. And in this episode, we are answering the Charge community's questions on menstrual health, cycle syncing, common women's health conditions, and fertility awareness. And I listened to the last episode and I realized when it comes to birth control, we mostly talked about it in the context of sexual activity. But I think it's important to talk a little bit about when it makes sense to be on birth control, if at all, if you're not sexually active. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a really great point. So birth control, definitely not just for women who are sexually active. It can also be a great support for women who have very heavy or painful cycles. A lot of the time, birth control can be used, particularly the birth control pill or a device like the Mirena progesterone-containing method that will help lighten period and sometimes regulate the period and often make it less painful. So this is really helpful for women who suffer from endometriosis or women who also have very infrequent periods, like women who have PCOS. For PCOS in particular, the birth control pill can be very supportive because often women with PCOS have an excess in androgen hormones, so an excess of testosterone, and the estrogen in the pill can actually help regulate those hormonal side effects as well. So it can help reduce the excess hair growth and cystic acne symptoms and infrequent periods that come along with that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. If someone has hormonal imbalance, is the birth control pill typically your first approach, or do you have another approach that you prefer before someone to go on the pill?
It really depends on the woman and it depends on her preferences and the severity of her symptoms. So the birth control pill can be a really easy, quick fix solution. Often with a hormonal imbalance, I'll try to educate on the diet, exercise, and lifestyle changes as well and bring those in. And the birth control method can just be a bridge in fixing those issues. For other women, if their lifestyle is such that they're having trouble implementing all of those lifestyle changes, or they're feeling a sense of urgency in resolving their symptoms, they might want to remain on the birth control pill for a long time if it works well with their body. For other women, you know, if they can take a little bit of time to modify things like lifestyle and diet and are hesitant to begin a method like the pill or hormonal birth control, we can really start to turn around her symptoms just with lifestyle changes alone.
And when someone goes on the birth control pill, how many weeks do you typically tell them to look for to really notice those changes?
Yeah, so it can take up to 2 to 3 months to really notice the full effects of the birth control pill. So I definitely do try to urge women when beginning a new birth control method to remain on it or give it a good shot for at least 2 to 3 months, because you can have some bothersome symptoms in the beginning when you first start a method too that will resolve over time. Some frequent spotting or irregular vaginal bleeding can be really common, in particular with the birth control pill, and does tend to go away the longer that you're on the pill. And so I do recommend that women will give it at least 2 to 3 months to see what the full effect will be on their body and to get rid of some of those annoying side effects.
Mm-hmm. The last question on birth control that someone asked, she said, are there any effects of switching birth control from name brand to generic?
So a lot of women will notice a personal change when switching from a name brand to a generic. The medication companies will tell you that it's exactly the same medication with exactly the same amount of hormone, and it's just a different name. But subjectively, a lot of women will report a difference in their bodies. So similar to beginning a new birth control method, if you ever switch from name brand to generic, I do recommend journaling, keeping a log of your symptoms. And if you find that you feel a lot better on a particular name of a pill, then I recommend telling that to your healthcare provider, and they can certainly write a prescription specifically for that pill.
Let's dive into menstrual health. So we did talk about PMS a little bit in the last episode, but someone also asked, what advice do you have for dealing with PMS emotions, and how do you know the difference between healthy PMS versus more concerning PMS?
It is normal to have some shift in your energy levels around the time of your period. So particularly in the 2 weeks before your period, it is normal to feel a little bit more introspective, a little bit more reflective, a little bit more sensitive emotionally. So some element of this just happens simply because of the change in our hormones that occurs during that time. But if anyone is delving into true depression, or if their mood irritability or symptoms are beginning to affect their quality of life, their relationships, their work, that's when I would say it's becoming beyond normal. Some of the things that you can do to help support healthy menstrual transition would be a vitamin B complex supplement taken in the 2 weeks before your period has actually been shown to help alleviate PMS symptoms. And I recommend all women be on a prenatal vitamin throughout the month, and making sure you get all of your nutrients and micronutrients throughout the month can really help a supportive transition. For some women, the birth control pill can also be really helpful in alleviating PMS symptoms if they become severe. There's also herbal remedies like Vitex, which we talked about on the last episode, that can really be preventative for PMS symptoms too.
What's your favorite brand of prenatal vitamins?
So I personally really like the brand One A Day for prenatal vitamins. I actually do the gummies because then I'll actually remember to take them because they're so delicious. But if you're looking for a really clean prenatal vitamin, there's one called MyKind, which is also vegan, has no animal products in it, and I've heard really good things about it from women.
Definitely going to start taking those. So good. What is your favorite form of menstrual products?
I personally am an advocate for either doing an organic menstrual products like tampons, pads, panty liners, or doing a menstrual cup. So menstrual cups are wonderful for a lot of reasons. They're very environmentally friendly because you're not purchasing any products and disposing of them. You're using a reusable cup that you sanitize between uses. And they're also nice because you don't have to run to the store and always be buying and getting new tampons and pads. So I think that's a really great option for women who are open to it. Definitely lots of different menstrual cups on the market, and not all of them work for every woman. So for sure, do your research on the size of the cup you should get and the kind that will work well for your body. And then in the realm of tampons or pads, panty liners, I recommend getting organic cotton brands. So Honest is the brand that I personally use, and I would recommend it for anyone.
Mm-hmm. Are tampons ever toxic?
So yes, there is something called toxic shock syndrome that can be caused through tampon use, it's much less common than it used to be. So it's often something that like mothers will warn us about is toxic shock syndrome, because it was much more common 20 to 30 years ago. The new tampons that are produced tend to be made in a way in which it's much less common for bacteria to accumulate and cause toxic shock. But it is very important never to leave a tampon in for longer than 4 to 6 hours to prevent this from happening.
So do you sleep with a tampon in?
I don't. I actually sleep with, have you ever heard of the Thinks?
Yes.
Yeah, so I tend to have like lighter periods. And so I'm able to do this. I just sleep with my Thinks underwear on, which is actually like absorptive underwear. You've probably seen ads for it on Instagram. I think it works great for me. I wouldn't recommend sleeping with a tampon in. You can sleep with a menstrual cup in or a pad, but with tampon use, really want to be careful never to leave a tampon inserted for longer than 4 to 6 hours.
With Thinks, do you wear that also during the day?
So I will wear it often during my period during the day just to prevent leakage, just in case. It's always nice to have a little bit of an absorptive backup. So I really like them. I have a few pairs and I wear them pretty much every day during my period.
I'm going to try that. Does it smell like blood?
No. So, I mean, you should change them out.
Yeah.
Every
How
day.
Often? Every day.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Or you could like.
So just like normal underwear.
Yeah. I mean, you could get two pairs and like wash them when you're wearing the other ones and then alternate, but definitely would change it out every day because they would start to smell if you're wearing it for a long time, just like any underwear, really.
Definitely. Yeah. Speaking of bleeding, what do you consider to be too heavy of bleeding?
So if you're ever at a point where you're soaking a tampon or a pad in less than an hour, then that is severely heavy bleeding. And you should for sure go in to be evaluated by a healthcare provider because there's probably some underlying cause or abnormality for the bleeding that you're having.
Okay, that's good to know. So anything over an hour is fine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Though if it's ever bothersome.
Yeah.
So if you're ever feeling like your periods are so heavy that they're starting to bother you, or if you're ever having symptoms of iron deficiency, like feeling lightheaded or dizzy throughout the day, then definitely could start a birth control method that could help lighten up your periods, start an iron supplement, or talk to your provider about other options for reducing your flow.
We did talk about this in the previous episode, but I wanted to mention it again just because we are talking about menstrual health. The question being, what is the best advice for very painful period cramps other than birth control?
Yeah. So Advil is an excellent remedy when not taken too often for period cramps. And then, of course, there's also the non-medical options as well. So taking a bath, doing certain yoga postures, using a heating pad. And then there's the herbal remedies as well. In particular, cramp bark can be really helpful for painful periods.
What yoga postures are good?
So anything that's very restorative, generally like long, slow postures that you can breathe through. So like my favorite one would just be like child's pose and breathing through that when I'm having a like severely heavy or painful cramps.
Mm-hmm. Why does it feel so good to be kind of curled up in that fetal position when you're having bad cramps?
I think it's because you're actually putting pressure on your uterus. Mm. So you're putting pressure on that muscle, and that can be really supportive in helping reduce pain.
So would you recommend massaging your stomach?
Yeah, you could do some light massage as well. I would say in general, like warmth and pressure are the key to helping alleviate painful cramps.
Does intermittent fasting cause issues with your menstrual cycle and fertility?
Intermittent fasting can cause a temporary change in your periods. So anytime you have a drastic change in your diet or exercise regimen, you may notice a temporary change in your amount of flow or when your period happens in the month. And this is also true if you ever have mental stress in your life. So if you ever have a job change or you're moved to a different city or experience some big upheaval in your life, it's common to have a change in when your period happens. It might happen a little bit sooner or a little bit later in your cycle. Same goes for major diet changes like intermittent fasting.
This may be more on the women's health condition topic, but someone asked, can you speak more on discharge? When should we be concerned?
Yeah, so it is totally normal to have vaginal discharge, and that vaginal discharge will change in color and consistency throughout your cycle. I would be concerned if you're ever having bothersome discharge. So if you're ever having discharge that has a strong odor, or if it's ever a very like clumpy white cottage cheese-like consistency, that may indicate yeast infection, or if you're having itching or burning along with your discharge, or a very abnormal color, like if you ever have like greenish discharge or brown discharge, definitely go in to be seen.
What does green discharge mean?
So it may be a sign of an STD.
So this is the last question on menstrual health, and it's about cycle syncing. So what is cycle syncing and how do we practice it?
Yeah, so cycle syncing is when you modify your diet and exercise regimens throughout the month to help support healthy menstrual cycle. So based on the time of the month that you're in, you can eat different foods which will help support your particular hormonal needs during that time of the cycle. So in the beginning of your cycle, so during the follicular phase where estrogen is rising, it's helpful to eat foods that will really help support that rise in estrogen levels. So lots of leafy green vegetables, nuts and seeds, and then around the time of ovulation, eating sulfuric vegetables like flour, broccoli, Brussels sprouts. And then as you transition from ovulation and you enter the luteal phase of your cycle, so estrogen and progesterone will begin to rise and then they fall right before your period. During that time, it's really helpful to eat very warm, supportive, nurturing foods like root vegetables. And then during your period, have broths and stews and foods that feel the most nurturing and supportive, which will help you both physically and emotionally during that time. As far as exercise changes go, so it is totally normal to have a big shift in energy throughout your cycle. So in the beginning of your cycle, while estrogen is rising and then eventually reaching its peak at ovulation, you're going to notice that you have a lot more energy and your workouts will be a lot more productive. So I would do your highest intensity workouts like HIIT classes during that time. Around the time of ovulation, people tend to be their most social, so you could do some classes in group settings as well. And then as your hormonal levels begin to fall later in the cycle after ovulation, you may want to do more introspective classes like yoga. And then during your menstrual cycle, so during your actual period, I would do like restorative yin yoga or something that feels really nurturing and slow.
Do you feel like you do a pretty good job working with your flow and incorporating these different foods and exercise routines within the month?
Feel like I could always do better, like all of us.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something that the more I know about, the more I find myself starting to bring in small ways. And I think also our bodies intuitively have a lot of knowledge.
So true.
You can really listen to your body as well. And the more you listen to your body, the more it will tell you what foods are really supportive for you and your particular health during a certain time. Like for me, I have a lot of sugar cravings before my period, which I think is very common. So I'll try to have like healthy sources of sugar around the house. So like we always have dates and we always have lots of like berries around the house for me to have when I'm having those sugar cravings so that I'm getting those needs met, but in a little bit of a healthier way.
I love that idea.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've read the book Woman Code.
Yeah.
So good. Highly recommend anyone who is really interested in diving deep into this topic to read that book.
Yeah, for sure.
And I would love for you to make a graphic. You might already have this on your Instagram, but talking about the different phases and what foods to incorporate and what exercise routines. I would love that.
Cool.
Yeah. Yay. Let's dive into common women's health conditions. So I have a bunch of different conditions to talk about. I'd love for you to share what each condition is and what advice you have for working with it. Mm-hmm. And then additionally, I thought it would be really interesting to talk about when holistic medicine is appropriate versus when it's important to have that Western medicine approach when working with these conditions. Mm-hmm. And are these conditions for life or are they something that will go away with a certain remedy? So the first condition is PCOS.
Yeah. So PCOS is a very complicated medical condition. So it's characterized by a couple of things. So it is a metabolic change. So women will notice that they have higher levels of daily blood sugar. So they may have a blood sugar imbalance and a little bit of a sensitivity to insulin. The other thing that they may notice is high androgen levels, so higher levels of testosterone. So that can result in some excess hair growth and things like cystic acne. And then it will also cause cystic ovaries. So if you have PCOS and they would do a pelvic ultrasound, they may see a lot of cysts on your ovaries because your ovaries are basically trying to release an egg and trying to release an egg and not actually able to release it from the ovaries. Women with PCOS will also have irregular periods, often infrequent periods as well. So caring for a woman with PCOS is really multifaceted. With lifestyle changes, you can reverse a lot of the symptoms and side effects of PCOS. So big thing for women with PCOS is weight control. So trying to have that person maintain a really healthy weight, eat a healthy diet, and get regular exercise. With a small amount of weight gain, you can notice a big change in the symptoms of PCOS. Another thing is helping that woman regulate her periods. It's actually harmful or potentially harmful to the uterus to have a period that is extremely infrequent. So you should be shedding that uterine lining at least every 3 months, or that lining can build up and cause harmful cellular growth in the uterus, which could eventually lead to cancerous cell changes. So it's really important for women with PCOS to make sure that in some way she's having a period at least every 3 months. And then another thing that's really important with women with PCOS is it can sometimes be harder for them to have children when they decide that that is something that they want. So it's important to start talking about fertility and fertility awareness and an eventual plan for that when the woman decides, if she decides, that she wants to have children.
Mm-hmm. For PCOS, is it hard to lose weight? Because someone asked, what tips do you have on losing weight if you are living with PCOS?
Yeah, so it can be somewhat more difficult to lose weight for women with PCOS because they have this major hormonal imbalance happening. Really, the biggest thing for women with PCOS is trying to reduce the amount of sugar and processed foods and bad fats in your diet. So sugar is kind of the first thing that I would want to target. So reducing alcohol intake and reducing processed refined foods, which of course easier said than done. So with women who are really struggling with weight loss, I always recommend making small changes at a time rather than having big major shifts that are hard to stick with. So choose one thing in your diet that you can cut out over the next 3 to 4 weeks. So maybe that would be reducing alcohol intake, making that a goal. And then once you feel like you've fully met that goal, then maybe make one more small change. But taking it one step at a time is definitely the most long-lasting way of making dietary and lifestyle changes.
Mm-hmm. Is there specific medicine for PCOS?
Yeah, so some women on PCOS will be on metformin, which helps with that insulin resistance that many women with PCOS have. Some women will be on birth control pills because the estrogen in the pills help reverse that androgen effect, hyperandrogen effect. Some women will be on spironolactone because that helps decrease their cystic acne. It really depends on the woman and what their specific needs are, but there's a whole array of medications as well as herbal supplements that can help begin to turn things around for women with PCOS.
Can you name a few of those herbal supplements?
Yeah. So spearmint is a really excellent remedy for women with PCOS. 2 cups of spearmint tea every single day help with that hyperandrogenism. So help with the signs of excess testosterone, like the increased hair growth and cystic acne.
And do most people live with PCOS their entire life once they find out that they have it?
So PCOS can be reversible. So if you make a lot of dietary and lifestyle changes, it can definitely be reduced. And in some cases, it's reversible.
The next topic is the most common STDs in women.
Yeah. So most common STDs are gonorrhea, chlamydia. And these STDs are treatable with an antibiotic. So if you ever hear from your partner that there was a possible exposure, or if you are ever having pelvic pain, irregular vaginal bleeding, or abnormal discharge, definitely go into a healthcare provider because these are very easily treatable and completely reversible with the right medication.
What does pelvic pain feel like?
So different in every woman, but some women will experience pain during sex, or some women will experience just kind of a chronic aching or stabbing-like pains different times in their cycle than just before their period.
Are there any other STDs that we should talk about?
Herpes is also an extremely common STD. About 25% of people have been exposed to herpes virus, and it's just becoming more common. It's a very important thing to talk to your partner about. If you've ever been exposed, or if you ever have suspicion that you might have been exposed, condom use is the best way to prevent transmission of herpes. HPV is also extremely common. It's not an STD, so it's not a sexually transmitted infection, but it does, transmission usually occurs during sexual activity. So it's caused by skin-to-skin contact between two sexual partners, usually during sex. Having been exposed to HPV virus is very common, and it's one of the things that they often screen for when you're getting your pap smear at your annual OB-GYN visit. If you would come back HPV positive, basically they'll want to do very close monitoring of your cervix using a pap smear for at least a few years. HPV can eventually cause abnormal cervical changes, so it could lead to cervical cancer later down the road. And so it's very important to monitor. I also want to reassure, HPV is super common. Most women who have HPV or have been exposed to it do not develop cervical cancer, but you're at a slightly increased risk. So it's just important to watch. HPV virus can be cleared from the cervical cells. And when it's not in the cervical cells, it's not active and it's not causing those cell changes, which could lead to cancer. And so I always recommend that women maintain a really healthy diet, exercise, and lifestyle, because the more that you're able to do that, the better chance you'll have that your immune system is working really well and HPV can be cleared from your cervical cells, which will reduce your risks of cancer later on down the road.
So it's more so dormant. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it can be dormant in your body and not active in the cells of your cervix. And only when it's active in the cells of your cervix will it cause those abnormal cell changes.
But it's not fully cleared ever once you are HPV positive.
Yep.
Someone wanted to talk a little bit about the HPV vaccine. She said that there are a lot of myths around the vaccine. Like, for example, you can't get HPV after you've had sex is a myth that she's heard, and she's not sure if it's true or not. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so HPV vaccine is an excellent way to help prevent cervical cancer. Basically, you are in the vaccine, it'll help protect you from getting certain strains of the HPV virus, which are known to be associated with development of cervical cancer. It does not cover all of the strains, so it's still really important to practice safe sex, condom use, to prevent exposure to other strains of the HPV virus. So it's protective, but it's not 100% protective.
I do want to talk a little bit about cervical cancer. I don't want to scare anyone, but the fact that you mentioned it, I feel like we should talk about it. What is the typical age that someone will have cervical cancer? And also, if you do find out that you have it, what does this mean with having kids?
Cervical cancer, or just extremely abnormal cell growth in your cervix, can really happen at any age and usually is very easily treatable. So if you would have positive HPV and in your pap smear, it comes back and you have severely abnormal cells, they'll usually do a procedure called a colposcopy where they actually biopsy the cervix and take a larger sample of cells and send that off to the lab. If that would come back as severely abnormal or indicating precancer or cancerous cell growth, then you may have a procedure called LEAP or cryosurgery where they actually do remove the outer portion of your cervix. So relatively treatable. And for most women, that will resolve your abnormal cell growth moving forward into the future. They'll still want to really closely monitor your pap smears after that to make sure that it doesn't return. But that can mean that you have a slightly increased risk of having preterm labor or cervical insufficiency during your pregnancy. So it is something that is important to tell your provider once you become pregnant that you've had a LEAP or cryosurgery procedure in the past. That said, there's so many women who get these procedures all of the time that have healthy, normal pregnancies. So it by no means that you will for sure have preterm labor or issues with your pregnancy. It's just important for us to be aware of it.
Absolutely. And last question on this, is it a silent cancer or will you develop any sort of symptoms?
Some women do have symptoms with cervical cancer, the most common being abnormal bleeding, particularly bleeding after sex. So if you would ever have bleeding every time you have sex, or lots of irregular bleeding throughout your cycle, lots of irregular spotting, definitely something to let your doctor know about.
Mm-hmm. And this is just another reason why we definitely need to be checking ourselves annually.
Correct. Yeah.
Let's talk about cysts next.
Yeah. So ovarian cysts, very common. They're actually the leading cause of pelvic pain. Cysts happen when you ovulate. A cyst is formed every time that you ovulate, and usually it resolves on its own completely over time. For some women, ovarian cysts will continue to grow after ovulation, sometimes grow very large and take a long time to be able to resolve on their own. Sometimes they become so large and often so painful that they will have to be surgically removed. some women are very prone to the development of cysts for whatever reason. So it is something that some really struggle with throughout their lives. Just like PCOS, one of the ways to help prevent the development of cysts is maintaining healthy diet and lifestyle as much as possible. Sometimes, even when you do everything right, there are certain women who just get cysts. And to be honest, we don't know why. So it can be very frustrating for certain individuals. Being on the birth control pills can help prevent the formation of cysts. So for those women where we've, you know, everything with diet and lifestyle is completely on point, they might consider being on a birth control pill because the birth control pill actually prevents ovulation. So when a woman is not ovulating, she's not forming that small cyst every single month. And so you don't have a chance to have cysts that will grow into be bothersome cysts.
Mm-hmm. Are there different meanings for cysts on different parts of your body, be it on the bikini line or on the armpit or things like that?
No, it's a similar cause. I mean, a cyst is basically just a pocket of fluid that can form in different parts of your body. Again, don't completely know why certain women are prone to them, but if you have cysts in one part of your body, you are more likely to have them in other parts of your body. A very common place to have cysts is on the bikini line or on your vulva. One of the best ways to help reduce a vulvar cyst is to do a warm pack. So to take a hot compress, like a washcloth, get it full of warm water, and then actually press it on the cyst a couple of times a day. Epsom salt baths are also really helpful in reducing the size and pain with cysts, and they'll help them resolve quicker when they happen.
Do you ever, I don't want to use the word pop, but poke a cyst? Like, does that happen?
Yeah. So if the cyst would become very, very large, then sometimes it may need to be drained. I wouldn't
drained.
Ever.
That's the word. I'm yes. Like, it's not pop.
Okay. I wouldn't ever recommend doing this at home. It's definitely something that should be done with a healthcare provider. Sometimes rarely cysts can become infected. So your provider might also prescribe antibiotic treatment as well. Usually this does not happen. Usually cysts are small, they're benign. But if you would ever have a cyst that's becoming very large, or if it's ever severely painful, the skin around it is red or warm to the touch, or if there's drainage coming out of the cyst that looks like it's a strange color, then definitely go to see your provider and they'll likely prescribe an antibiotic for you.
And then last question on cysts, do they travel?
So the same cyst would not travel.
Okay.
So you would never like have a cyst in your armpit and then that moves across your body to your leg. But women who are prone to cysts for whatever reason, or they at a certain time in their life are prone to cysts, they may have a cyst in one area of their body that goes away and then a new cyst that forms up in a different area of their body. So it may seem as though it's traveled, but it would really just be that it's a different cyst.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a cyst on your body, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have ovarian cysts, but it is probably more likely that you may have ovarian cysts than someone who doesn't have cysts anywhere.
Correct. Yeah. It is normal.
The next condition I'd love to talk about is yeast and bacterial infections.
Yeah. So this is extremely common as well. Chronic infections are also very common and super, super bothersome for women. Some of the most just like sad and desperate patients that I've worked with are patients that have chronic yeast infections or BV. So it can be extremely hard. But basically, yeast is an overgrowth of candida in the vaginal area. It's usually characterized by white, sometimes cottage cheese-like discharge. There's usually itching or burning associated with it. And with a yeast infection, kind of the standard treatment for it is being on a Monistat, which is a vaginal ointment, or taking a pill called Diflucan, which will help resolve the symptoms. But often with that, you're not really treating the underlying cause, which is a shift in your vaginal pH. So a shift in the acidity level of your vagina and an excess of sugar in the diet. So for women who have chronic yeast infections, I really recommend decreasing dietary sugar, maybe reducing alcohol intake, and then beginning a probiotic. And you can do the probiotics either by mouth, you could do it vaginally, and that'll help turn around that vaginal pH to be at a little bit healthier level and help prevent infections down the road. BV is another very common infection, and BV is usually the symptoms that women will have would be an excess clear to gray discharge that has a very foul, often fishy odor. And that's usually treated with antibiotics. Just like yeast, it's caused by a shift in that vaginal pH. So probiotics can be really supportive in prevention. The other thing that I recommend for all women is if you have chronic BV or yeast infections, avoid wearing non-breathable materials. So avoid leggings for a little while, wear cotton underwear, no pants at nighttime. If you are ever sweaty after working out, change out of that clothing as soon as possible, and then don't stay in any damp clothing like wet swimsuit bottoms, because that will help prevent getting an infection as well.
Someone asked, why do I get a BV every time I have sex with my partner? He's uncircumcised, but very clean.
Yeah, a lot of the time women having sex will trigger a BV infection. It's very, very common. Condom use can help prevent that. The other thing would be after sex, just cleaning up with just water afterwards. So doing a vaginal flush with just clean water. Wouldn't recommend any sort of soaps to the vaginal area, because harsh soaps can actually really throw off pH.
And when talking about the yeast and bacterial infections, you talked about the different medications you can take. Is it typical for someone to take that for their entire life, or is it more so you take them for a little bit, it clears up, and then you don't necessarily have to worry about it anymore?
Correct. So for yeast, it's usually just 1 to 2 Diflucan pills. For BV, it's an antibiotic called Flagyl that you usually take for a week. And then ideally, in a perfect world, your symptoms would completely clear up and never come back, but recurrent infections can be really common, which is why it's so important to do those preventative and lifestyle interventions as well if you ever have these infections. For women who are chronic sufferers of yeast or BV, another resource I would direct you to is Aviva Rom. So it's spelled AVIVARomm. She has a lot of resources on her website for women who have these recurrent infections, including an option for an herbal vaginal suppositories using the herb Golden Seal, which can really help reduce these chronic symptoms in a natural way.
The next condition is endometriosis.
Yeah. So endometriosis basically is a condition where the lining of your uterus, those cells start to grow in other areas of your body besides your uterus. Usually symptoms of this will be very severely painful or heavy periods, sometimes pelvic pain during sex or other times of your cycle as well. This is actually a hard condition to diagnose. So a lot of the time women with endometriosis will often go on kind of a long journey before they finally get diagnosed with this condition by their medical provider. The only way that the medical system sees as fully being able to diagnose endometriosis is by actually viewing the lesions, so those patches of cellular growth, in a surgical procedure. So using a laparoscopic imaging to actually see them. But a lot of the time, women will try lots of different options to try to help reduce the pain that they're having before they get to that point. And it can sometimes be a late stage when they're diagnosed. So what I recommend is whenever you are having pelvic pain, or if you think that you may have endometriosis, if you have all of the signs of endometriosis, getting to a specialist as soon as you can. Because a lot of just run-of-the-mill OB-GYNs truly don't know a lot about endometriosis. And there are some amazing specialists that this is their area of study. And so I recommend going to a specialist if you suspect that you may have this condition. Kind of the standard way of treating it would be going on a birth control pill to help suppress ovulation, which may reduce your symptoms, but it doesn't reduce symptoms for all women. And there are lots of different other options for treatment besides just starting a birth control pill. So that's something that a good specialist will be able to walk you through, all of the different options and the risks and benefits, so that you can come up with a plan that works for your unique body.
The last condition that I'm sure everyone has experienced is ingrown hairs. Yeah. How do we get rid of them?
Yeah, so ingrown hairs, one of the biggest thing is prevention. So if you at a certain time are very prone to ingrown hairs, actually taking a break from shaving or waxing can help prevent them. And then similar to a vulvar cyst, warm compresses applied a couple times a day or Epsom salt baths can help heal an ingrown cyst that's already formed.
I will also say laser hair removal.
Yeah. That's another
can
great,
be huge.
Yeah, totally. Yep.
Is there anything else about vagina health that we should talk about?
So I would say that with vagina health, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the vagina is a self-cleaning organ. So a lot of people will use like harsh soaps or chemicals to try to really, quote, clean their vagina. But that's actually not necessary and can often lead to more problems like infections down the road. So just very non-harsh soap like Summer's Eve or just flushing with warm water is the best way to support vaginal hygiene. Definitely avoid harsh chemicals or douching vaginally.
The last big topic that I'd love to talk about in this podcast is fertility awareness. We also got a ton of questions on this and pregnancy and reproductive health. So I'm really excited to dive into this. First, what is fertility awareness?
So fertility awareness is noticing the signs in your body, which will begin to indicate to you when in the month you're ovulating and when in the month you are the most fertile. So some of the signs of fertility are changes in your cervical mucus. So around the time of ovulation, your cervical mucus will take on like an egg white-like consistency, so become like very stringy and sticky. Other changes will be in your basal body temperature. So if you're taking your temperature every morning, that temperature will shift around the time of ovulation. There are actually lots of apps that can be really supportive in helping monitor these symptoms. So the one that I personally use is called Natural Cycles, just because I'm curious about those changes. And it will actually tell you the time of the month that you are the most fertile and when you should be especially careful about using protection if you're trying to prevent pregnancy or if you're trying for a baby, the times of the month when you should have sex more frequently.
Can you talk about the effect of age on reproductive health?
Yeah. So we touched on this a little bit in the last episode, but you become what we consider to be advanced maternal age at the age of 35. And the around that age, it also becomes harder to conceive for many women. And so there are lots of ways to, of course, promote fertility at any age. So even after the age of 35, there's lots of ways you can work with a reproductive specialist if you're having trouble conceiving. So I don't want anyone to feel like they need to have babies before the age of 35. It's such an intimate and personal decision, and one that should be made in complete confidence about whether or not you want to have children. So I want to validate that at the age of 35, it can be a little bit harder to conceive, but absolutely there are tons of resources available to help with conception after that age.
Someone asked, are there any signs or indicators that you might have trouble getting pregnant?
So one of the biggest signs that will determine whether or not you'll have ease of having children is regularity of period. So if you have very regular menstrual cycles that happen around the same time every month, then it's likely that you're ovulating regularly and won't have trouble conceiving when that time comes. For women with very irregular cycles, I would recommend going into your women's healthcare provider and possibly getting some lab testing, which can help determine the cause. But you may have a little bit more trouble conceiving because your ovulation may be irregular as well.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of lab tests, are there any fertility testing that you recommend? And at what age should this be done?
So there is lots of stuff out there that will advertise fertility testing to see what your perfect fertility level is. But to be honest with you, infertility tends to be such a multifaceted thing and can be caused by so many different factors that there's no perfect fertility testing, which will tell you 100% whether you're fertile or not. Really, the biggest thing I would recommend is if you're having irregular cycles, going into your provider to get certain lab testing like an FSH, prolactin, possibly estradiol and progesterone testing, thyroid testing, and testosterone screening, because that will give you a really good picture of what possibly could be causing your irregular cycles, and you'll be able to get the treatment that you need before you actually try to conceive. But other than that, for many women, it's just a matter of trying for pregnancy. And then if it doesn't happen within a year of actively trying to conceive, going to a fertility specialist for further workup. And for women older than the age of 35, after 6 months of actively trying, if you haven't been able to conceive at that point, I would go to a fertility specialist.
I think it's really good to point out that time frame between 6 and 12 months, because I feel like people might be really nervous after a month or two of not getting pregnant. Like, oh my gosh, is something wrong with me?
Right.
Rather than like, this takes time. It's okay.
It does take time. Totally. So that is something that is a great thing to point out, is that if you've just been trying for a month or two, no stress. It can just take time for that perfect harmony to happen where the sperm meets the egg and baby's able to grow. So can take up to a year, even for completely healthy reproductive women to be able to conceive.
And touching on what we talked about in the last episode with birth control, it may take an additional amount of time.
Correct.
Because like you said, like it does take time after you stop birth control to have regular periods again for some people.
Correct. Yeah. So for some people, after stopping the birth control pill, for example, it can take up to 4 months for your ovulation to return.
Mm-hmm. When do you think it makes sense to freeze your eggs?
This is a very personal choice, but if you are beginning to approach the age of being advanced maternal age and you do not see in your near future that you'll be actively trying for pregnancy, then that's definitely something that you could consider, is undergoing a process where your eggs are frozen so that at the age that you decide you may want to become pregnant, IVF is a more viable option.
Are all of your eggs frozen?
No. So they give you hormones that will help your body ovulate and ovulate more eggs than usual. So more eggs than you would in a normal cycle. And then they actually go in and harvest those eggs and then freeze them.
Gotcha. What is the biggest factor that someone can control to preserve and protect their fertility?
So really the biggest thing to preserve and protect fertility is maintaining a healthy diet and lifestyle as much as possible. So all of you guys are already doing an amazing job of that by being a part of the Charge community. So having a community that will help support your health, but having regular exercise, maintaining a healthy weight, eating a healthy diet, taking a daily multivitamin, these are all ways of protecting your fertility down the road and making it so that if you do conceive, then you'll be able to have a healthy pregnancy as well.
Back to IVF. What is your personal opinion on when to decide if IVF makes sense for you? Like, I'd love for you to give an example of maybe a possible situation in your life when you realize, like, okay, IVF is the route that I want to go.
Yeah. So this is definitely something that you would talk about with a fertility specialist. So women who are having trouble conceiving will usually be meeting with a reproductive endocrinologist or fertility specialist. You'll usually have a full workup where they'll do a pelvic ultrasound. They'll usually check the patency of your fallopian tubes. They'll often screen to see what your ovarian reserve is. And they'll do full hormonal lab testing to really identify what the cause of your infertility is. There's also such a thing as male factor infertility. So in some cases, it's not the woman at all that is the cause of infertility. It's actually something that's abnormal in the man's semen analysis that's the cause. So after kind of that full workup, if they find that IVF is the right option for you, then for some people, that'll be what they pursue right away. For others, they'll be able to do other things to help induce ovulation or do intrauterine insemination before IVF to see if that works. Those are much less invasive and less expensive options. But for some women who they are not able to sustain a pregnancy besides having the egg and sperm meet outside of the uterus and then implanted into the uterus, then IVF will be the option from the get-go. So it's really something that you would talk to a fertility specialist about.
I feel like we should mention miscarriages.
So miscarriages are actually very common, a lot more common than most people realize. About 1/4 of women have experienced a pregnancy loss or a miscarriage early in their pregnancy. And it's something that we don't talk about a lot in our culture. Like, it's a very taboo thing. Often it's something a woman holds in secret and doesn't share with a lot of people, but they are extremely common. And I always want to reaffirm to people who have experienced a miscarriage once, that doesn't mean that you will experience another miscarriage in the future. It's very common to have a single miscarriage, and it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you or that it'll continue to happen to your body in the future moving forward.
I feel like we can definitely have an entire pregnancy podcast, so we won't fully get into that. But the last question that I would love to touch on regarding fertility is actually on the flip side. Someone asked, can you share more information on getting your tubes tied if you are positive you never want a pregnancy?
Yeah. So getting your tubes tied is basically the decision to permanently prevent pregnancy. And it's a totally valid option for people who know with definite certainty that they never want to have children. I'll be honest with you, it can sometimes be hard for younger women to find a doctor who's willing to do this for a young woman who's never had a child before. But like I said, it's a totally valid option, and I would recommend continuing to seek out a medical provider who's willing to do that, because they are out there, and every woman should be able to have the ability to make choices about her own reproductive health, and it's a valid choice.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of our reproductive rights, I love this question. How can I get control of my reproductive rights in today's political climate?
Yeah. So in today's political climate, I truly believe that learning about our own reproductive health and reproductive choice is a radical act. And the more you can get involved in local and state politics and support initiatives that will help provide free birth control for all and medical services for all, the more you'll able to support other women and yourself being able to get the women's health care you need.
Is there anything else that you recommend? For example, getting an IUD that can stay in your body for a long time.
For sure. So yeah, like if you're concerned about your ability to be able to pay for something like birth control pills, or if you're concerned that your reproductive options might be taken away from you at some point, then doing a long-acting reversible contraceptive method like an IUD or the Nexplanon can be a really great option for getting long-term birth control.
Mm-hmm. I would love for you to touch on racial disparities within women's health.
Yeah. So I'm really, really glad that this question was asked, because this is a huge, huge problem that is definitely being more readily expressed right now, given the Black Lives Matter movement. But there's a tremendous disparity among Black and women of color in the quality of healthcare services that they receive. And much of this is directly attributed to racism factors. So if you control for the woman's educational status, environmental factors, then there is an element that it can only be accounted because of racism of our medical system and of healthcare providers that causes a disparity in the quality of healthcare that women receive and in healthcare outcomes. So about 3 to 4 times more Black women will die during childbirth because of the racial disparities in our country. Something that has been a huge problem in our country for a long time is the use of Black bodies for medical experimentation. And to be honest, this is something that still kind of continues to this day. Teaching hospitals and hospitals where there's a larger amount of basically like research being done on the bodies of people tend to have a larger amount of Black and Brown people who are the clientele of those hospitals. Another big factor is that people just tend to take the experience of women of color less seriously, particularly the pain of women of color. So when women of color report to their healthcare provider, there's something seriously wrong with my body, or I am having pain in my pregnancy that's not normal, they're less likely to be listened to and taken seriously. And this is reflected in the healthcare outcomes that we see among these women. So women of color are much more likely to die from pregnancy. They're much more likely to suffer poor health outcomes, experience things like preeclampsia and preterm birth. To be honest, this is just something that's unacceptable. It should not be happening. There are lots of resources that I would recommend for women to learn more about this. One of the best ones that I've found is Instagram page called Mama Glow. They have a lot of really great information about this. So one of the best things you can do is actually donate to their doula fund. Basically what that means is they have a fund which will help sponsor women of color to become doula practitioners. Doulas are an advocate for women during childbirth. and they'll help advocate for the healthcare needs of the women that they serve. So it's very important for us to have women of color playing this role to be able to support women of color who are going through the childbirth process. It's extremely important in general to have more people of color who are healthcare professionals, because the more you are able to meet with a healthcare provider who looks like you and doesn't have any implicit bias towards you, the better healthcare you'll receive.
Mm-hmm. Such good information, and something that I think every woman needs to dive further into for sure.
Yeah.
Let's end on checking ourselves annually. In what way should we be doing this?
So I definitely recommend an annual exam with a women's healthcare provider. They'll be able to talk with you in depth about all of the things that we talked about in this podcast. So your reproductive health, the kind of birth control that you want to be on, sexual health practices. You can get STD testing if you are sexually active as well. And then they can check your annual lab work. So checking your thyroid hormone annually, checking things like your vitamin D level, and then also making sure that you get a pap smear if you're due for that. Make sure that you're vaccinated on your HPV to prevent cervical cancer down the road. And then also do a clinical breast exam as well. And make sure that you're not having any lumps, bumps, or abnormalities in your breasts.
Thank you so much. Yeah. This was incredible. I am so happy we did this. Aww. I'd love for you to shout yourself out. I know that you have incredible resources, and also telehealth. I want you to mention that too.
Yeah. You can find my personal Instagram, anna.naturally. And then I actually just started a women's health Instagram too, called inner.glowing. And then if you would like to do a telehealth visit with me, I actually am on the platform Maven. So you can schedule a telehealth consult. And those are probably the biggest ways to find me. If you're in the Denver area, I work at a holistic clinic here as well. You can always reach out on my Instagram to get more information about that. But yeah, I am so happy that I had the opportunity to do this and to share some information. And seriously, anyone, do not hesitate to reach out if you have more questions.
Yay. I hope some of you listening can work with Anna. I would love to see that. And we should do a charge event in the future. I think that would be really fun on women's health.
Yeah. I would love that too.
Thank you all so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Charge Girls, good morning. Yes, I'm talking to you. It's time to get charged up, because this day is anew. The sky says hi, and it's bluer than blue. The sun is shining, and all the birds are chirping too. Today is the best day to be alive. The miracles appear once you open up your eyes. Surprise! Time to keep living your dreams. So get up and join the rest of your charge team.